On the phone with me right now is Kenny Vance. Thanks for joining me, Kenny.
My pleasure.
Kenny, ever since the PBS show has been airing in Northern California, and that's been happening over the last couple of weeks, I've been getting a lot of calls asking about me playing some of the Kenny Vance and the Planetones music. Tell me a little bit about your experience on that PBS special, and I think it was called Doo-Wop Cavalcade.
Correct. We basically taped it, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago in Atlantic City, New Jersey, at the Sands Hotel, and all of the groups were there. You know, Harvey from the Moonglows was there, and the Cleftones were there, and all the groups that you see on the show. Basically, we just did our thing, which is the song that we're most noted for is Looking for an Echo. And Looking for an Echo, I'm going to send you the CD. The original CD came out as an album on Atlantic Records in 1974. And I did a song called Looking for an Echo. And it was basically me playing acoustic guitar. And I was singing it like a folk song. It was a folk song. It was basically a folk song about growing up in Brooklyn and listening to Alan Freed on the radio and then going down into the subway and trying to imitate the groups that we had heard on his radio program. And the reason we went down into the subway is because it's like a cavern, and there's a great echo chamber in there. So even if you weren't really good, it would magnify it, and it would make us sound good. I guess in the early 90s, I decided to form the Planetones. And the Planetones were in a movie called American Hot Wax,
right,
which is the Alan Freed story. And I was the music director on that film. I guess for people that don't know, you know, in your neck of the woods, you know, how I started and who I am, basically started singing doo-wop in the late 50s, early 60s in the subway and Church Avenue in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue, and then kind of had a little doo-wop group, and then we parlayed that into an audition with Jerry Lieber and Mike Stola in the Brill Building, which is 1619 Broadway, which in the early 60s housed all of the record companies, small labels that you play, Ember Records, Hull Records, and Herald Records, G, Rama, Gone, and we auditioned in 1961 for Jerry Lieber and Mike Stola, who were producing the Coasters and the Drifters, and who also had written Hound Dog for Elvis Presley, and, well, they wrote it for Big Mama Thornton, but Elvis copied that, and Going to Kansas City, they wrote, and many other songs, and they were record producers, and we auditioned for them, sang a cappella, and they decided to record us, and they gave us a name called Jay and the Americans. And the first hit that we had was in 1962 with She Cried, and I stayed with that group until about 72 and had many, many hits with them, and I could name some of them. Karen Mia, Come a Little Bit Closer, Let's Lock the Door.
How about Only in America? I bet there's a story about that one.
Well, we had a hit in 1962 with She Cried, which actually started being played on the West Coast. And this is about 4 months after it came out. And somebody in Northern California, I believe, started to play the song. And it became a hit and slowly worked its way back to the East Coast. And because it was a hit, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stola needed to continue producing our record. In those days, Jerry and Mike had a stable of writers and producers up there. And they had Phil Spector, Burt Bacharach, Ellie Greenwich, and Jeff Barry, to name a few. And these were all young people who were starting out in the business, and Van McCoy also, and they produced records with us that weren't successful. And then in 1963, Jerry and Mike had recorded a song called Only in America with the Drifters. And I was up in the office, and I said to them, boy, wouldn't that be great if you gave that song to us? And I guess for some reason it made some sense to them to do that. And what happened was they took us to Atlantic Recording Studios. It was an innovative studio at the time because they had 8 tracks.
Mm.
Up until that time, the state of the art was 4 tracks. And before that, a few years before that, it was just stereo. And they would bounce the tracks. You know, that's another story, but you know how to how they recorded in the early days. But they put our voices on, and by that time we had a new lead singer. That was his first hit record, and he had taken Jay Traynor's place, and his name was Jay Black. And he recorded that song, and it came out, and it was a big hit record. It mostly was a big hit record down in Florida. For some reason, there's a lot of Cuban immigrants that had come to America, and they kind of embraced the song Only in America as their anthem.
Mm.
So that started us going, and then a year later we had Come a Little Bit Closer, and then Let's Lock the Door. A year after that we had Caramia and Some Enchanted Evening, and then a couple of years went by, and you know, with other recordings that weren't successful. And we did, in 1969, a remake of This Magic Moment, and then a year later we did a remake of Walking in the Rain. So we had about maybe 10 top 5 records in throughout the 60s. And then what happened for me was in 73, I was signed as a single artist, a solo artist, with Atlantic Records, and I made an album that had the original Looking for an Echo on it. It was not successful, but several disc jockeys, oldies disc jockeys, I think took a liking to the song, kind of embraced that record that I had made, and played it for 20 years. And it took about 20 years for it to become a cult classic on the East Coast. And right around that time, I decided to start reform the Planetones in around 92. And I was going to make a CD, and when I made a CD, I recorded Looking for an Echo over again. And a friend of mine, who I had worked with in the movie business, let me just digress for one second. After the album came out in 1974, and it was not successful, somehow I wound up in the film business as a music supervisor, and I worked on American Hot Wax, which is the Alan Freed story. And if any of your listeners want to pick up the DVD, they can do that on my website, which is kennyvance.com, because it's really an authentic portrayal of the early days in Brooklyn at the Alan Freed show at the Brooklyn Paramount. In the movie is Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and then also some fictitious groups that I put together, one of them being the Planetones, and that was in 1978. And then it was also Jay Leno was in the movie, and Fran Drescher. It was their first movie. They were young kids. The Planetones disbanded after that film, but it led me to a career in the film business, and I wound up doing some music for Animal House and The Warriors. Later on, Hairspray, and then I worked on Eddie and the Cruisers. If you see that movie, there's a guy, Sal Amato, that plays at the Holiday Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen closely, you hear my voice coming out of his mouth.
Hmm.
He sings those oldies but goodies, and Betty Lou's Got a New Pair of Shoes. It's on the Eddie and the Cruisers album. And then, I guess it was around 92, as I said, I recorded a new CD. And the guy who was the director of the movies that I had mentioned was doing a movie, and he was calling it Dreamboat. And when I sent him my CD, he says, you know what, I'm going to change the title of the movie to Looking for an Echo. And so I had to re-record the song again. And this time, I re-recorded it with that falsetto beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Woo-hoo! And that's the version that we wound up doing on the PBS show. What happened was, like, I guess, throughout the 90s, the group The Planetones just became more popular and more popular. And, you know, we started to play in Las Vegas at the MGM Grand, and started to play in Atlantic City. And now, you know, we play all throughout the East Coast, and I think that's how the PBS people heard about us, and they called us up and they said, we'd like you to be on the show. And it's been quite an amazing journey, you know, being on that PBS show, because the show is shown all over the United States. And all of a sudden, we're getting emails from people like yourself that up until this time probably didn't know that we existed. So it's very gratifying, and it's also a miracle on some level that this song, Looking for an Echo, recorded in 1974 by myself, has taken, you know, 30 years to sort of popularize itself and also, you know, my group. I know that was a kind of a long-winded answer, but...
Very informative, however. Well, let me back it up just a little bit and talk about some of your beginnings. Where did you grow up exactly in the New York area?
This music, you know, the oldies, I mean, I don't like that term. You know, to me, it's really American music is what it is. At this point, it's historical American music, and it almost, to me, when you think about it, it took me a long time to realize this, but you know, those early records by Frankie Lyman and the Dubs and all these different groups, there was no such thing as a rock and roll musician in 1954, 55, 56, 59. So these groups would come off of the street. They'd come off of the street, you know, in Brooklyn from Bedford-Stuyvesant, would come off of the street from Harlem, would come off of the street from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, where the Verrazano Bridge is at this point. It wasn't there then. And they would make up songs under a street lamp. And songs like Could This Be Magic? Songs like Don't Ask Me to Be Lonely? You know, songs like Why Do Fools Fall in Love? They would work the songs out a cappella. And then they would take a train to 49th Street and Broadway in Manhattan, the Brill Building. And they would knock on doors. And then they would go into these fly-by-night record companies, because in those days, Columbia Records and RCA and Decca, they didn't want to record this music. This was kind of beneath them. So what it did was it opened the window of opportunity for all of these small labels to start to exist, you know, like George Goldman's labels of G Records and Gone, Rama, End. And so they would go to Birdland, where these bands, these big bands would come in from the Midwest, from Kansas City, like Jay McShann's band would come in. And he had these great players. They were jazz players, but to make a couple of extra bucks. And they were also men. The guys who invented the songs were young teenagers. So that kind of amalgam of these old jazz players playing bass, drums, saxophone, guitar, and these kids singing their pure little doo-wop songs is the thing that created this unbelievable music from the 50s. And so that's why when we listen to these records, they're extraordinary. You hear these solos, the sax solos, they're like bebop solos. You know, they're not, the instruments are not being played by kids.
Right.
And so that was an amazing kind of thing that existed at that time. And that's why those records withstand the test of time, because they're extraordinary records. I look at it like they're jazz records. You know, you listen to those Flamingos records, they're impossible to reduplicate, and also, you know, they capture a moment in time. To me, they're not dated at all. You know, it's like if you listen to Miles Davis or if you listen to John Coltrane or any of those guys, that music is as fresh today as it was then. And to me, this music is also as vital as it was then. I think because of Grease and because of the Fonz, and, you know, like this music has a like an incorrect stereotype that it's trivial, but it's not at all. And it's profound and deep on some level, in its purity and in its innocence. You know, for me, I just feel blessed and lucky that I can still, as I get older, still work in this medium and still work, you know, with the kind of music that I grew up with, and the kind of music that I love.
Your first group was called the Harbor Lights. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The Harbor Lights, it's amazing. I was 15 and a freshman in high school, and a friend of mine introduced me to this group of people that were trying to form a group. And, basically, they were in the neighborhood. It was a girl by the name of Sidel Sherman, who played the piano and wrote songs, and Sandy Yaguda, who, along with myself, a couple of years after that, formed the original Jay and the Americans. But the Harbor Lights made two records. We made our first record for Jarro, called Is That Too Much to Ask? And What Would I Do Without You? And then we recorded for the Mala label. And I know Paul Simon was on that label with his group Tico and the Triumphs.
Right.
And we recorded a song called Ticka Ticka Tock and
Angel of Love?
That's the thing, yes. Yeah.
So how did those records do locally for you?
Well, locally, the first record was actually played on WINS, and WINS was the station that Alan Freed was on. But he was gone from the station, and Cousin Brucey, Bruce Morrow, was the disc jockey there, and he actually played it. And I remember in 1959, I think when it came out, 1960, we got booked at Palisades Park, and on the bill, we were the opening act for Tony Bennett with the Ralph Sharon Trio.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was 16, and we played with Joanne Campbell and Dickie Doing the Don'ts.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, traveling from Brooklyn to New Haven, Connecticut, which was like, you know, another universe at the time. And playing in a firehouse. And, you know, that was kind of my induction into, like, performing. I never, you know, as a kid, you just think, well, maybe you like music, and then maybe you'll have a group. And then, if you're lucky, you make a record. The result of making a record actually gets you out on the road. I never really knew that that part of it existed. But we did start going on the road, and it was really a very, very eye-opening experience.
So besides Alan Freed and Cousin Brucey, were there any other DJs that that you listened to that you recall?
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, before Dick Clark was on, there was a local TV show with a guy named Jocko Henderson, and he was on the local station here. He was a disc jockey out of Philly, and he would run shows at the Apollo, Jocko's Rocket Ship Show. And I also would listen to a lot of the black stations. There was a station out of Newark called WNJR, and there was a guy named Pat the Cat. And then there was a guy named Dr. Jive, Tommy Smalls, on WWRL. And these were guys who would play a little more, you know, esoteric songs like Love Call by the Ebonaires, and they'd play songs by Tar Heel Slim and Little Ann. And I just read that Tar Heel Slim was in the Larks that did My Reverie with Eugene Mumford.
What a great group that was.
Unbelievable. That song, My Reverie, unreal.
Well, going back then to the early times then, I also read somewhere that you did hang around the Brill Building a lot. You know, you had mentioned some of the information on the Brill Building, but I was kind of curious to know is what your goals were for just, you know, hanging around the Brill Building. Was it to get a contract? Was it to see the other groups, or just what?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think, you know, when you're 15, especially then, maybe 15-year-olds now are much more sophisticated, but we went there, I guess, in the hopes of auditioning. And then once we got there, the juxtaposition of that environment as opposed to where I had grown up was so diverse or so exciting that I used to look forward to going there and just hanging out. And on one side of the Brill Building was the Turf Bar. And in the back of the Turf Bar, there were like phone booths. So everybody that didn't have an office would use a phone booth and use that as their office. And you would see all of the musicians that had come in off the road from Kansas City, the jazz players, they would all be hanging out there. and all of the guys that owned the record companies were hanging out there. So there was a certain kind of freneticism that, you know, that was infectious. Just being around it, you kind of got caught up in it, and it was just a larger-than-life, you know, atmosphere. And, you know, in those days, for $100, you could make a record that could conceivably sell a million copies. So, you know, a lot of all kinds of different characters were involved in the record business in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to make a score.
Heading forward, I guess, I understand that not only did you open for the Beatles and the Rolling Stones on different occasions, but it was on both of the first tours for those groups.
The first time the Beatles played in the United States, we, along with another group or two, were the opening act, and we got to hang out with the Beatles backstage in Washington, D.C., I think it was February, 18th, 1964. It was either the week after they had played on Ed Sullivan or the week before. And I remember, you know, we played. We had a couple of hits in those days, you know, Only in America, She Cried. You know, the Beatles came out, and they basically had these small amps. You know, it wasn't like nowadays where you go to a show and they have these gigantic amplifiers and, you know, tremendously sophisticated sound systems.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, it was just like, you know, just the band, you know. So what happened was when they came out, the place went crazy, and, like, they just screamed through the whole show, so you really couldn't hear that anything that they were doing. I think it was just the fact that they had that hair, and they would wiggle their heads. It was that, you know, innocent on some level. And it wasn't for a couple of years later where the Beatles really developed into who they were to become. It's amazing. You know, they led us to spirituality and gurus and gave people permission to dress any way they wanted and gave people permission to have long hair and things like that. And, you know, people nowadays just sort of like take that for granted. But before the Beatles were on the scene, we lived in a pretty sterile world here. The same thing about a year later, we were on the show with the Rolling Stones. We were the opening act for the Rolling Stones at Carnegie Hall in Manhattan. And Murray the K was the disc jockey. There were two shows. And I remember being backstage with them, and we had just been on TV playing on Shindig, and we were using pancake makeup.
Hmm.
Who knows why, but we were putting makeup on, and I remember Mick Jagger and Brian Jones coming over to me and, you know, wanting to borrow my sponge. So maybe I actually started the trend of glitter rock. But we opened the show, and then they came out, and of course the place went insane, and I'm watching these guys, and basically what they were doing was playing Muddy Waters songs. If you know much about Muddy Waters, and you listen to his early recordings with Little Walter on harmonica, I'm not that familiar with who was, you know, Willie Dixon on bass, and it was really the prototype for who the Rolling Stones were. They were basically a blues band. We were guys wearing alpaca sweaters and tight black pants and, you know, like turtlenecks.
Night and day there.
Night and day. And so the disc jockey, he comes up to us and he says, listen, he says, you guys got to close the second show. I said, what are you talking about? We can't follow these guys. He says, if you don't follow them, he says, there's going to be a riot. Anyway, he kind of talked us into it. So the second show, the Rolling Stones opened the show, and of course the place, it's their first time in America, and the place is going crazy, Carnegie Hall. And they finished their set, and what they wanted to do was sneak them out the back. So now he says, and now from Brooklyn, New York, Jamie American. And we were like a popular group. We come out on the stage, and we're actually, our opening number was Only in America. And by the time we had gotten to the halfway mark on the song, the audience was getting up and running out of the theater. And by the time we finished the song, we had cleared Carnegie Hall. Because they were running around in the back trying to catch the Rolling Stones as they were making their exit.
Huh.
And in retrospect, you know, you see that these were really clues for us. See, we were in a historical spot to be able to see that firsthand. And it was a signal to me that, like, the world was changing and that tastes were changing and that things were changing. And for me, it was just a couple more years that I stayed with Jay, and then I left. And then luckily, you know, I made that song Looking for an Echo, and luckily I wound up in the film business. And then I guess as time goes by, you know, everything old is new again. I don't know what you know, philosophically, what you want to say about it, but I mean, the Planetones basically do, you know, 50s R&B. You know, we're booked all the time.
Yeah, I was looking at your schedule, and it looks like you must be doing at least 100 or so dates a year, at least.
Yeah. No, it's unbelievable. And, you know, I'm not a kid anymore. Although, you know, when we get to do it, I'm, like, transformed back into being that kid that I was when I first started. Thank God I can still sing. And then I think the audience is also transformed back to the time when they were kids. And so it just becomes a wonderful celebration of the music. You know, it's just, you know, an extraordinary event, you know, for me as well as the audience. So that's kind of what I'm doing nowadays, and, you know, very fulfilling. And it's really, I look at it like, it's a miracle for me to be having a second career at this point, and I appreciate it so much more. And, you know, the reason I got into the business was to be a singer. And then, of course, you know, you have a family and there are economics and you have to, you know, get a job. And so to be able to be doing this now is just, you know, unbelievable.
Well, I think your music does kind of transform, and it, you know, people think and imagine themselves back in a different time. And I really think the performance on the latest show here did that. I really like the fact that you did Looking for an Echo. It sounded good. Your voice sounds good. It sound, you know, you have this ability to hit the high notes, or at least that's how I perceive it. So who
saw on that TV show is basically, you know, what we do live. And we could play for 20 minutes. We're going to be in Pittsburgh playing in the Mellon Arena with Jerry Butler, Fred Parris and the Five Satins, Johnny Maestro, myself, and it'll be a sellout, and they'll have 20,000 people there. Pittsburgh is a huge town for this kind of music, and as you know, their hometown favorites are Jimmy Beaumont and the Skylanders.
You're absolutely right. Pittsburgh absolutely loves the music.
Yeah.
I know that T.J. Lubinski actually did several of his shows.
That's where it started, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Right. Tell me, who are the Planetones?
Well, the Planetones have changed over the years. Like, this particular incarnation of the group has got Johnny Gale, Angel Rissoff, and French Iagian. When I first started the group in American Hot Wax, it was Joe Esposito, Eddie Hokanson, and Bruce Sedano. And then over the years, Bruce has been in the group, and Eddie has been in the group, and then at one point we had Gary Bonner in the group, who wrote Happy Together.
Mm-hmm.
For the Turtles, and it's just guys who are my age, you know, they're 58, 59, 60, up, you know, like that area of age, and the guys who've been in the business and who are still good singers and sort of have a certain integrity about the music, and we want to be as aesthetically, you know, accurate as we can, you know, just to really somehow have a certain purity to it. And that's what we do. You know, I knew when we started it, we weren't going to get a Clive Davis come down and give us a record deal. Or we weren't going to get on American Idol. You know, I don't care. I never thought about it for one minute. I just knew that this was the music that we loved, and if we got a chance to do it, maybe there would be an audience for it, and the audience is larger than I ever dreamed would be there.
Tell me about the latest CD that you have called Lover's Island.
We just recently got a deal for it. I made this over a period of 2 years, you know, a little studio in Queens. Musically, it speaks for itself. We did a lot of songs that we always loved. We did a little different interpretation of some of them. I think what it does is it kind of works for now. In other words, I don't really look at it like it's dated in any way.
Mm-hmm.
We just did get a deal with national distribution on Varese Saraband Records, And you could go to, you know, any, like, Borders. I don't know if you have Borders out there or if you have Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could go on the computers there and you'll see Kenny Vance and the Planetones. And, again, I didn't do it with that in mind. I just did it knowing that the fans that knew about us would want a new CD, a follow-up, so to speak, to Looking for an Echo. That's what it is. So the fact that we have national distribution, you know, who knows where that could lead? I don't know.
Well, you've got some great songs on this one. You know, anything from the Skyliners' Lonely Way to Jerry Butler's For Your Precious Love and Diamonds and Pearls, the Paradon songs.
I think my favorite is For Your Precious Love.
Well, is there anything that I've missed that you want to tell my audience here in Northern California?
Thank you for calling. You know, I appreciate it. And I'm happy to talk to you again if you want. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the response is. And if you want, at some point, for me, what would be the greatest is somehow we could do this again and maybe people could call in and I could talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to get feedback from different parts of the country.
Very good. Well, Kenny, thank you very much for spending some time with me tonight and talking about your career. And we look forward to some more great music and great things to come.
Thank you, Brian. And keep the music alive, man. We need it.